Welcome, everyone, to the Unconventional Wealth Podcast. Joining us is Jeremy Ryan Slate, the mastermind behind the Create Your Own Life podcast and co-founder of Command Your Brand. Jeremy's not just any guest. He's a literary scholar turning podcast powerhouse whose journey takes us from the hallowed halls of Oxford University to the forefront of the new media revolution. Jeremy has a knack for dissecting the lives of high achievers and distilling those insights into actionable strategies for his audience. Today, he's here to share his wisdom on overcoming failure, sparking innovation, and why taking the road less traveled might just be the secret to creating your own life and financial path. Jeremy, I love all of that. We're totally aligned, it sounds like, in the things that we're interested in. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. And I guess just since it's relevant now, since people have been talking about it on TikTok, my master's degree is in the Roman Empire.
Oh, you were ahead of your times, I guess. Very
apparently.
Well, let's jump right into the hard-hitting stuff here, because in your bio, we talked about, it mentions overcoming failure. So can you share a moment in your career where you faced significant failure? How'd you handle it? How'd you turn that situation really into a win or a learning opportunity?
Well, I think the thing that's interesting, and you and I were talking about this a little bit before we got recording, I think like sometimes people think that you have to, even if it's not what you want to do, you're just going to run with it because you're going to be successful with it. And I think a lot of times it has to be a match for like our skill set and also what we want to do. And I think for me, the thing that's really interesting is, as I mentioned, like I have a undergrad degree in Catholic theology, and then my master's is in the Roman Empire, which are two things that 20 years ago weren't very useful. So I got out of school in 2011 and I wanted to be a teacher. Like that's really what I wanted to do. And I ended up teaching in a high school for a couple of years. And I will tell you, like those kids had me for lunch because I'm almost 40. And you can imagine like at like in my mid 20s, how young I looked, seeing how young I look now. And it really didn't work out well. I got burnt out really quick. And then in 2012, my mom ended up having a really, really bad stroke. And it made me look at a lot of the things I was doing in life. And I'm like, is this really what I want to be doing? And for me, then I looked at a lot of different things and I tried selling life insurance. I did network marketing. I did online marketing. And I started a podcast just because I wanted a creative outlet. So this was back in 2014. And we had 10,000 listens in our first month and we had a lot of success early on. And it took me a year before I even figured out how to make money with it. It was really just a side project I was doing while I was working at somebody else's marketing agency. So for me, it was being faced with, you went to school for all this time for this thing, and this is what you're going to do the rest of your life. And you get there and you're like, I really don't like this. And I just had to figure out like, what is the best fit for my skill set? And frankly, not even worry about the money right away, because you have to find out like, what is a good fit for you? And you'll work everything else out.
Immediately, what jumps to mind, I talk a lot about what I call the two tyrants of leadership, scrutiny and expectations. No matter what you do, where you're at, you get a ton of scrutiny. And then the same people who scrutinize you then later have all these expectations. You're like, hold on, how does this make any sense? I'm just imagining all of the scrutiny that you were getting from friends, family, when you finished with this master's degree from a prestigious university, and now all of a sudden you're going in a totally different direction. What were the things that you were being told?
So that's actually where the podcast name came from, Create Your Own Life, because I was having this conversation with my dad at the time. And he's, listen, son, like people don't get to do what they want to do. Like you work at a job for 40 years and then when you're retired, you have a few years, you get to do something. And I'm like, I don't want to do that, Dad. I want to create my own life. So I got a lot of pushback, man. And it took a bunch of years. Like when I say a bunch of years, like it took a good 3 to 5 years before the opinion started turning the other way. And I think a lot of times what people don't realize is if you get on purpose and you start working at what you want to do and you start having a little success and a little success and a little success and it starts snowballing, what you'll find is there's about 2% of the people in the world that just like really aren't good people. But most good people that maybe have different expectations for you, if you push long enough, that pushback is going to turn to admiration. And what's really been cool is as I've started to have more success, do more things, those people that early on had different expectations for me, and it's hard, man. Trust me, it's hard because your parents want the best for you. They want you to do the right thing. Neither of my parents went to college. So this was really like the be all end all for them. And I was throwing away like everything they wanted from me. So I think the pushback initially was really hard for my parents, but it really turned the other way as I kept going, kept pushing and started having success at what I was doing. And they're huge supporters now. But I think for a lot of people that they get that pushback early on, And that kind of stops them in their tracks because they don't want to make somebody else unhappy. They don't want to disappoint them. But at the same time, like, you got to think of, sure, you care about your parents, you care about your friends, but like, why would you live your life for someone else like that? Right. And I think that's one of the hardest things, is to realize you're the person that has to live this life, tolerate it, and enjoy it. So you really do have to understand, like, what is this doing to me?
A line that comes to mind from my longtime mentor, I got to credit him, Randy Massengale. He says, you pay full price on your unused potential. And I was wondering how that strikes you just hearing your story so far.
Well, I think it's, you pay full price, but I think a lot of times you pay more than full price, like, right? Because if you don't maximize your potential, it also takes away from you, right? Because if you're not focusing on what you're good at, you're focusing on other things, you're focusing on things you don't enjoy, well, those things are harder. Those things don't flow as well. Those things, it can take a toll on you through life. So I think to not, like, sure, it can take the full price, but frankly, I think it takes more than the full price on a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the cost is significant to just do what everyone else wants you to do, or expects you to do, in spite of what you're capable of, or the life that you want.
And you got to ask yourself a lot of times, like, where does that come from, right? Because I think sometimes, like, you'll have people in your life that, like, they just want to see you do well, so it's a letdown to them. Well, you'll have other people that actually feel threatened by your success. So you have to realize it's a very small percentage of people that feel threatened by your success. You just have to realize where it's coming from and accept it for what it is and just keep pushing, man.
100%. Yeah. So we're all about unconventional strategies to build wealth on this podcast. And wealth is really just the life that you want. Everyone has their own unique definition of wealth. If you were to think about your definition of wealth, what would come to mind? What are the things that you want that you would say, hey, I'm wealthy?
I think it's, as I said, I'm closing in on 40. And I think, like, it's changed a lot in my mid to late 30s, as opposed to what it was in my 20s. Like, it was a lot more about ambition and money and what was I doing. And I'm a dad. I have two kids now. I have a third on the way in June. Yes. Thank you. And we don't have a lot of property, but we have a few acres out here in New Jersey. We have 24 chickens. We have a pig. For me, I love that kind of a life of getting up every morning and feeding my animals and doing it with my kids and counting the eggs with them and going down the river with them. And also at the same time, like, I get to talk to people for a living. How awesome is that? So I think for me, like, yeah, we do well income wise, but at the same time, like, I get to do things I love absolutely every single day. I work from home. I spend a lot of time with my kids and I'm at every soccer game. So I think to me, that's real wealth, right? Because if you have everything in the world, but you don't get to spend it with the people that matter, doing the things that matter, what's that good for?
100%. So you come out of college, you've got these very specific degrees, although I might argue, because I went to a liberal arts college, a Jesuit university, that it really can be applied to all areas of your life. And you start teaching and then you make the shift into entrepreneurship. What did you know about finance and money at that point?
Absolutely nothing. And I think actually even to my detriment as well, because I think for me, as I mentioned, my dad didn't finish high school. He tried to play professional baseball. He had an injury. And that was once he was in the minors for a couple of years, that was the end of it. My mom, her senior year of high school, her dad had cancer. So she was basically like raising her brother and doing everything else. So my parents had a very rudimentary understanding of money. And for them, like $100,000 was like the most money you could ever make. And actually, I was even having a conversation with my dad this morning. He's like, oh, excellent. So family friend just won the lottery and won $3 million. He's like, that's a lot of money. And I'm like, it's not really that much money, Dad. But there's a lot of things you can do that can generate money like that. So I think early on, I had a very rudimentary understanding of money. And because of that, I didn't understand like the value and what it can do for you, the investment it can do for you, and the different vehicles you can use it in. That's something I've learned a lot more as being a business owner. What are the things that matter most? What is the value of my time versus my money and things like that? But early on, I had a very rudimentary understanding of money. And I think I made a lot of stupid mistakes early on because of that.
So Jeremy, I have to admit that I'm struck by how similar our life stories are.
Really?
In not the professional baseball part necessarily. Okay. But my dad also didn't finish high school, and neither my parents have college educations. My mom basically raised her two younger siblings. So I'm just thinking about
that. Wild, man.
Parallels of our lives. I'm the first person in my family to go to college.
I've lost count at this point. I have over 100 first cousins and 60 something second cousins. I'm like, I was the first one in my entire family to go to college of that many people. That's wild.
Yeah, that is wild. I don't have that big of a family, but again, similar story.
Yeah.
And so I ended up going a different route in terms of education, accounting, business degrees, basically. And growing up, what I learned was just you save as much as you can, you pay off your house as fast as possible. And those were sort of the principles that I had. And along the way, I've learned how that can actually result in designing a system that guarantees that you're going to have to work until your mid-60s.
Yes.
In fact, if you tie up all your extra capital into retirement accounts, you can't access until you're 59 and a half. That guarantees you're working until you're 59 and a half. Most people would like the opportunity to have financial freedom sooner. Do you remember the types of financial rules that you grew up with? And then I'll have a follow-up question for you after that.
Yeah, so you actually got me like working through them in my head here while you were talking. So my parents, like, they hated the idea of credit. Like, mm-hmm. they always had this one credit card, and it was, I always remember, it was a $3,000 card, and it was always maxed out, and they'd always make a payment on it so they could go buy something. Like, so like they were terrified of credit. And because of that, like, even still to this day, my dad still pays for everything with cash. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to invest in a lot of things. He doesn't want to put it in different vehicles. So it's literally like just cash in the bank is how he does everything. And I think, number one, your money's not working for you. Number two, once you're run out of it, like that's the end of it too. So I think it's a very rudimentary idea of what to do with money. And I still see it to this day.
Similar. And, you know, when you grow up, I understand where they're coming from. In my parents' case, if you grew up with not a whole lot and you're changing your whole family tree, that you're trying to maintain stability as much as possible. Unfortunately, that can create the situation, though, where you got to just keep grinding.
Yeah.
So what types of financial rules, if any, would you say that you've built now that you've been in this entrepreneurial journey for, I think, about a decade, it sounds like?
Yeah, so yeah, over a decade at this point in time, which is crazy, man, when you think about it. But
happy anniversary.
Thank you. When you look at it, like the number one thing I'm taking a look at is what's the value of me paying for something versus me doing something. And I think when I look at it, like so many times there's more value into hiring another person, bringing on a contractor, you know, paying for a different program rather than doing something myself. So that's the number one thing I'm looking at, the value of my time versus the value of money. Because most of the time, the value of my time and what my abilities and everything can go for is much more and what the money is going to cost me. So that's the number one thing I'm looking at. I'm also looking at the interest something generates versus the debt it creates. So an example, like I'm a big fan of like whole life insurance as an investment opportunity, because if you can get like a good one, like we've worked with Guardian for years, there's a 5% rate a lot of times on the actual, you know, what it makes a year when it compounds, and you can take a loan out against that whole life policy. And a lot of times the penalty is only like 2-3%. So you could still be spending the money, like buy a car, whatever it is you're going to do, but you're actually making a percentage of money on the money you're paying back. So like, to me, it's how can I always make money on the money I'm spending and also use it better?
Interesting you mentioned that. On the whole life, there's sort of these levels.
Like infinite banking is what I've heard it called.
Yep, infinite banking. If and when you reach a level called qualified client, or specifically qualified purchaser. I don't know if you're familiar with these levels, accredited.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm at those levels yet, but we're working, man.
as you do, then you get access to something called private placement life insurance, which is a concept that functions very similar to whole life, but has some additional advantages in terms of types of investments that you can use that structure to get into. So just since you mentioned whole life, that might be something down the road. I don't sell that product. I don't sell any financial products. So don't come at me. I'm not trying to make any commissions, internet.
Well, the one thing, like I read a book a number of years ago, and I honestly can't remember the title of it, but because it led me to reading a bunch of his other books. But the guy was Garrett Gunderson. And Garrett talks a lot about looking at how do rich people use their money. Because I think that's the number one thing a lot of us do is a lot of us are trained to use the money how people that don't have money use their money. And I think when you do it that way, it's always the banks that win. And I think when you learn the actual rules of the game, like and how rich people use their money, there's lots of that.
100%. Yeah. If you look at the paradigms and you go, okay, there's a gap between the 1% and the 99%. There's been a lot of data published about that. There's an even bigger gap between the 1% and the 0.1%. The gap continues to grow year after year. That the gap, if you go back to 2008 and the financial crash and the gap between the 99% and the 1%, and then you look at it today, it has grown exponentially.
Yes.
And so that just kind of bolsters your point that if we just copy what everyone else is doing, guarantees that we're going to stay where we're at.
Yeah, because consumer debt kills people, man. Because if you look at it like an auto loan, right? An auto loan is, it's dumb, right? Because you're going to pay a monthly amount for something that's already depreciated 30% since you've driven off the lot. So a lot of times you're in better shape buying something used with a clean title and buying it cash where you can get a beautiful car and you can get a lot less on it. Unless, I know there's some tax loopholes where if you buy something that's large enough as a company car toward the end of the year, you take it off as a business expense. But a lot of times if you're doing things as a personal level, like a lot of consumer debt just isn't that smart.
Yeah, and the tax strategy you're talking about is if the vehicle weighs more than 6,000 pounds, then you have an accelerated depreciation deduction. Yes. You can take. So just to fill in that point.
Once again, I depend on my accountant for all this. He's like, you should do this. I'm like, great idea.
Yeah. What you're pointing to is being strategic with how you're spending your money. And to me, the highest leverage strategy is always, if I can fund a goal that I already have and get a tax deduction, that's a home run.
Yeah.
So wanted to get the vehicle anyways, and you get a large tax benefit. Now we're actually taking the money we would have been paying to the government and using it to pay towards this vehicle that we wanted.
Yeah.
What would you say, shifting away from talking about money and coming back into how you help people, do you have any favorite stories from your podcast where you've heard maybe some unconventional strategies or just someone with a different point of view that really struck you as unique and something you'd want to implement?
I don't know if it's a unique thing, but I hear the same theme again and again and again. And we're at like 1200 episodes at this point. So like I've been having these conversations for years. Like the theme I see again and again and again is like this theme of adversity and like what it does for people. Because the regular person, like they're going to see something difficult, they're going to see something hard, and they're going to either run the opposite way or try and hide from it. Whereas people that embrace that, they may understand like, hey, this is going to be hard. This might be the hardest thing in my life. But if I can grow from this, if I can become better from this, it's an incredible opportunity. Look at somebody like Tom Brady is one of my favorite examples of this. You look at, I don't know if you're a football fan, Dan. I am a huge football fan. Well,
I get triggered when Tom Brady comes up because I'm a Seahawks fan. So,
well, I'm a Green Bay Packers. I'm a Green Bay Packers fan, but I use Tom Brady as my example all the time.
Okay, so you might get triggered when we talk about the Seahawks, because there was a game against the Packers that came right before the Seahawks Patriots.
Yeah, that and 4th and 26 against the Eagles. Yeah. But anyway,
we don't need to talk about that stuff. Yeah.
But I guess looking at it, if you look at Tom Brady, right, he's somebody that he barely started his junior year of high school because he only started because the starter got hurt. In college, his senior year, he completes with Drew Henson to even play, gets drafted in the 6th round, only plays because Drew Bledsoe goes down. And he just, every one of those things, he learned from them. He was studying, watching film all the time. He runs like he's got a piano on his back. So like he just learned how to read things before they were going to happen. And I think when you can build a skill set that's so good that you deal with all the things that you can't put on paper, I think that's where the real value in that is. So like taking adversity and saying like, how can I build skill sets that other people can't have? And unless they were pushed to this point, they couldn't build. That's the biggest thing I've learned.
Yeah, there's another principle again that I'm just shouting out my mentor today. He calls it the tank.
I feel like I'm yelling your talking points at you here, man.
Like I said, it seems like we have a lot in common. It's just similar point of view, life history. He has this saying, tank versus trunk. And you can either take that adversity and put it in your trunk and drag it around as baggage for the rest of your life, or you can put it in your tank and use it as fuel to burn towards propelling you towards the life that you want.
Yeah. And I think when you look at that, like, that's the problem with giving every kid a trophy, Dan. Like, there's real value in losing. Because if you could take a look at that and say, you know what, if I don't do that, if I don't do that, if I don't do that, I can learn something from it. Napoleon lost the Battle of Waterloo. And it's actually one of the most studied battles in history, because it was only a few chance things that made him lose that battle. So if we can learn from our failures, there is so much value in that. But we're told like, hey, everybody gets a trophy. It's fine. And when it's okay to lose if you figure out how to not lose again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you have, when I hear about losing and failure, I think about risk and how to manage risk or weigh the trade-offs between all these different opportunities. Do you have any points of view around risk and how you manage that?
You got to weigh the risk with what the benefit is, right? If my risk is only a certain percentage of something that's going to happen to me, but the percentage of it helping me is way better, then absolutely I'm going to take that. So I'm often doing that in hiring a lot of times, where I'll overhire for a position I need because I want to make sure that I'm putting myself in the position to get the right person, right? Because a few dollars an hour or dollars a year or whatever it may be for income is different than finding the right person. So if I want to hire one, I usually hire three because I know one of those is going to be the right person, is going to work out. And the amount of money that I'll lose for the two people I let go or the one person I let go is negligible for kind of the lost time in running another campaign and hiring, right? So it's like you take a look at what's the value to me versus what am I going to lose? To me, that's what I'm often looking at.
I think that's a really, really important takeaway for folks who struggle with hiring. I know that's a really specific example.
I overhire, man. It's big.
I think that's a, I hope a lot of people take away from that, share that specific approach, but also the B message, which is that you have a philosophy and a point of view and you're being strategic about the moves that you're making. That's what I heard. You're being strategic and you're being calculated and you're not afraid to make a move, it sounds like. So if you have to, you let a couple people go.
Well, it'll surprise you sometimes too, Dan. Like I've hired like two or three in the past with the idea of, okay, we'll let the best one win. And I found myself keeping more than I intended to because I hired more good people than I thought I was going to as well. So like it can also put you in a better position than you expected too. So it's, you got to be open-minded to it.
Yeah, I call that rigging the game. That's what my book is called too. But basically you're putting yourself in a situation where you win no matter what.
Yes. But
worst case, I walk away with just one person. Best case, I got three killer hires. It's awesome. I love it. What do you think is, what is one of the biggest misconceptions about being an entrepreneur that you'd like to try and debunk?
Oh man, that there's so many to that, dude. I think number one,
you don't have to limit it to one. Yeah, what are?
Well, I think number one, like a lot of people don't understand the difference between public relations and marketing, and that really hurts them, right? Like public relations is this idea of creating trust, getting people to understand who you are, know you, like you, and trust you. And then once you have that market knowing you, like you, and trusting you, you promote to it. That's marketing. But a lot of people, they look at that thing as if it doesn't generate leads for me, so then I can't do it. If that's your game, man, you're going to be playing Hungry, Hungry Hippos forever. And I just see that with so many entrepreneurs. Now, the ones that get it realize the right PR program is going to change the perception of me, the perception of my brand. And then when I run a marketing program, it's going to be more successful. That is one of the number one things. I think one of the other things, Dan, is the amount of time it's going to take someone to be successful. And I see this especially with people that maybe they were in corporate first and they decided to start a business. They think, okay, so I need 6 months of income and I'm good. And for a lot of people, it might be years of income to be good. So you have to really understand, like, you're going to work hard, you're going to do the right things. It doesn't have to take a long time, but it's usually going to take longer than you think. Be willing to put in the time, the effort, and take every single opportunity you can get.
It feels like a killer opportunity when you're talking about time, to tie that back to the Roman Empire.
Yes.
There's some saying about that.
What do you mean? What saying are you thinking of that I'm missing?
There's something about it wasn't built in a day.
Oh, it wasn't built in a day, and then it took 400 years to fall, so.
Right. Well, you were just talking about the importance or the difference between PR and marketing and and the buildup. How does that tie into your new book?
Well, because I think most people have the misconception, like with how the media cycle works, that they're just going to keep doing good stuff and people are going to discover them one day and it's going to be magical. And I've had people tell me this in like actual talking about working with our company. And the actual, really what's happening is you have to be out there in every place possible, getting your message out in the right way and getting it out in a way that makes impact. Because so many times people don't consider what makes my story interesting. What is that thing? Like I've found myself, we mentioned it through this conversation, a trend popped up on TikTok about 3 months ago about why do men think about the Roman Empire so much? I find myself in the position, Dan, of one of the few people that can take Roman history and make it communicate to the regular person since my degree is in that. So now I'm getting all these media placements that I never would have gotten before because it's relevant and it's the right story and it's at the right time. So I think when a lot of people are looking at media, they have the misunderstanding that the media is going to find you. They're not, unless you do something that gets you arrested. And they're just going to be interested in my story because you have to make it relevant and timely. It has to be continually out there. It has to be relevant and it has to be timely. And you have to figure out, how do I actually cut through the noise? Because there is so much noise out there. I think I'd have to look this up, but the last time I saw it, it was like people see 8,000 marketing messages a day. So those are all the things that you have to bust through to get somebody interested in your story. So if it's not timely and it's not relevant, you're going to keep being obscure as a brand. Like you have to be continually creating opportunities for yourself.
And you've got a new book out. Is it, I know the website that people can go check it out is bestpodcastbook.com, which is a killer vanity URL. Nice job on that. Is that also the name of the book?
Yeah, so the book is called Command Your Brand, Grow Your Impact, Income, and Influence in a New Media Landscape. And it literally helps people to do everything I was just talking about there of getting your message put together in the right way, making it relevant and timely, getting it out there and finding the right podcast and new media to get it on. So as you said, that's over at bestpodcastbook.com.
Is there one strategy or one little tidbit you'd feel comfortable sharing from the book?
I think the one thing I would say, Dan, is like a lot of people, when they start trying to get media, they don't have any media. So for a lot of people, I tell them what's called a small pond strategy. So what is the small pond that you're a big fish in somewhere? So I'll give you an example. Like I grew up in a small town. It's 5/8 of a mile in size and doesn't have a grocery store. Sure. The only thing relevant about my town is that we have railroads and Babe Ruth used to golf there. That's it. Sure. Other than that, it's not relevant. So the really winning strategy about that, though, we have a small newspaper that goes to every town in the every house in the county on a Thursday, and their press day is Tuesday. So if I write a press release, I send it in, they're going to run it. Now, here's what's really cool about a lot of modern print newspapers. They also have an online version. So now you're creating backlinks for the media page on your website. You can do this with your university. You could do this with your lake community. You could do this with your Rotary Club. All of these companies and organizations have small pieces of media that you can get. So you could build this portfolio of press and show people you're noteworthy. So then when you start approaching bigger media, larger podcasts and things like that, they can see you have some experience. Because the number one thing that these organizations want to see is number one, that you're credible, but number two, that you're actually able to like communicate what you're talking about. Because for a lot of people, like they're not able to coherently do that.
What I liked about what you just shared is that it was philosophical, but it was also very actionable. A lot of times people give a very high level, like, okay, that sounded really good, but I don't know what to do with it. But I appreciate the specificity and that my brain is churning on things that I could do similar to that. So I'm going to check out the book. Everyone else listening, go to bestpodcastbook.com and check it out as well. Jeremy, thanks so much for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
Hey. Dan, I think I found a kindred spirit. Thanks for having me, man.
Absolutely.